When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com.
Farm Africa!
Oye!
Uganda!
Oye!
Kanungu!
Oye!
Youth!
Oye!
Women!
Oye!
Coffee!
Oye!
UK!
Oye!
What you've just heard is the reaction of farmers in Kanunga, Uganda, to hearing that Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal has launched. Between 8th of February and 8th of May, donations in support of my London Marathon Challenge will go to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal. If you can donate before 8th of May 2019, all public donations to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal will be doubled by the UK government. What a country. Your donation will support Farm Africa projects across Eastern Africa, and the matched funding you unlock from the UK government will directly fund a Farm Africa project that will give women in Kanungu in Western Uganda the opportunity to make a decent living from coffee farming. I'm trying to raise £5,000 to support the appeal, and if you could spare anything at all, we would greatly appreciate it. Just visit justgiving.com/fundraising/William-Evans12, and I will put that link in the show notes. Thank you. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 111. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading across the country to Suffolk to talk to arable farmer Brian Barker. Brian, how are you?
Evening, how are we?
Very, very good. Slightly frustrated because half the farm is underwater at the moment, but I'm trying to smile through it.
Yeah, we've had a little bit of rain over here, but not as much as you. But then I have just written down that we are actually the Nelson of interviews, so the 111.
The 111, yeah. You are a cricket man, aren't you, like me? So you'll be hopping on one leg now, I presume.
Yeah, I am, yeah. It's going to be the end of my good luck.
I hadn't thought about that till you pointed it out. That's great. So seasoned rock and roll farming listeners will know what a massive history nerd I am. So I was always going to ask you about this. Your farm has a very high historical importance, as Mary Tudor of the Tudors fame actually once lived on your farm. How cool is that?
Yes, yeah. So Mary Tudor, when she was obviously married off by her brother Henry VIII, she was sent off down to France, and she married, and this is where my history is pretty poor, but correct me if I'm wrong, Louis XII, to become Queen of France. And she was quite young, he was quite old, there's about a 30-year difference. He apparently died exhausted. is what's pretty much written in the history books. And so Henry VIII had the idea of sending his best friend, who was Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, over to collect her, to bring her back, to basically marry her off to another king in the Europe, to sort of do sort of cross nation good bits. But when Charles Brandon actually arrived in Paris to pick her up, she begged Charles Brandon not to take her home, and so they married in secret in Paris, and came home in disgrace, and Henry VIII basically banished them and fined them a huge amount of money. I can't remember off the top of my head how much money they were fined, and then he forgave them. And obviously, because she was married to Charles Brandon, who Charles Brandon was one of his best mates from being a childhood with Henry VIII, forgave them. And so they basically took up residence in Westhorpe Hall and built a very grand and royal country retreat, which is fully moated. There's a three arch bridge, which is still there today. So
wow. We've got a
three arch bridge. And then there was courtyard, portcullis, courtyard, chapel, all that sort of stuff in this massive sort of moated site. And so Westhorpe Hall was a real big area for history, and the family own Westhorpe Hall, and it currently is a old people's home. But yeah, the actual original building got pulled down because it was too expensive. But the moat is still there, the bridge is still there, and the brickwork is all still there, which was sort of schedule entry monument, which we've got to look after.
So, wow. Wow, that's really, really cool. And it was your grandfather who bought the place, right?
Yeah, grandfather bought it in 1958. Mm-hmm. He was a local Suffolk farmer. Mm-hmm. And he was actually farming next to the Cross and Blackwell family of Brunston Pickle.
Yeah, okay.
And they wanted to buy the family farm just down the road. And they kept on offering him more money. And one day he got so much money offered to him that he couldn't say no. And so he became farmless, and Westhorpe, the lodge at Westhorpe, so the hunting lodge of Charles Brandon's Westhorpe Hall, was on the market, and it was known as a overgrown, wet young man's project. And my grandfather bought it, and my grandmother said when he came home one day, he bought it on auction, got it very cheap. There was a story of a bid being taken by the fly walking down the wall. No one wanted it. And my grandmother, he came over to my grandmother and he said, yeah, I've just bought a farm in Westhorpe. And she goes, well, you can't have. I haven't even seen the farmhouse. And he goes, well, I bought it so cheap. If you don't like the house, I'll build you a new one. And she luckily saw the house where they where we are now, and the original house is still standing. So, yeah, we've set up our family home, and we've added bits of land as we went. Well, not I myself, but my grandfather and my father and my uncle, mm-hmm. who added to as farms in the village came in. I think when we bought the farm, there was something like sort of, I think it was 8 or 9 different other farms in Westhorpe, and now mm-hmm. we're the only one. So,
is that right? Okay.
Yeah. Scary how it's all changed.
That tells its own social history story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So you left school in 2001, the year of foot and mouth, as we all know in the UK, and prospects in farming weren't great for a young person then.
No. Yeah. So I basically left Framlingham College, and I was looking at things to do with my mm-hmm. my A-levels, and my parents said farming's not great. At the current time, the wheat price was £65 a ton. We had a pig herd that was just about making money because we were feeding them such cheap wheat. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty dire, foot and mouth, the risk of our whole pig herd being killed overnight. Mm-hmm. So they basically said, just go and do something else. Think about what you want to do. We're not going to do anything rash with the farm. We'll keep going until we know what your plans are.
Mm-hmm.
See my cousins as well, because there's obviously quite a few of us. And so I basically decided that I would go and travel the world, so Australia, New Zealand, Cook Islands, traveled with two of my best mates, and did all what we should have done, jumping off bridges out of airplanes.
Yeah.
The stupid things, which you look back now and go, crikey.
Yes.
And then came home and decided to sort of pursue a sort of environmental sort of background, mm-hmm. and to Lancaster University, where I went and studied environmental science for 2 years.
Okay.
And 2 years was, well, brought to a very sharp halt when they talked about dissertations. And they tried to make me write a 4,000-word essay on an environmental impact assessment on a Chinese pipeline. The first question was, am I going to China? And the second, well, the answer was fairly short. And they said, no, you just got to do it from what we tell you. And I was like, this ain't good. But while I was there, everything I was talking about was being related back to farming in my head and all my work.
Yeah, okay.
And the day that England won the World Cup rugby in 2003, wasn't it? No, was it 2003? Yeah.
I've tried to blank it out of my mind so I couldn't tell you.
Rugby on such a big weekend that we just but yeah, no, the day that England won the World Cup, I basically wrote a letter to my lecturer saying, I don't want to be here. Mm-hmm. All I think about is farming. And so he said, no, I thought it was coming. You write like a farmer. You can't spell. So
I was going to say, you write like, how does a farmer write?
Badly. I came home and my parents said, well, if you want to take on the farm, you need to have a qualification above and beyond anyone you employ. Mm-hmm. So I was like, right, here we go. So then looked around and I ended up doing agricultural business management, finishing off my degree at Rittle in Essex. And that's what I did. And then came home and sort of, Bob's your uncle, here we are.
Choosing to do environmental science, though, were you always interested in nature and the environment?
Yeah, I think we've always been brought up with it. Yeah. Myself and my sister were taken to pretty much every national park in Britain for our sort of summer holidays. Mm-hmm. Geography, farming, conservation, shooting, from my dad, from my mum, from my grandfather, from my uncle, mm-hmm. David, he was a countryside commissioner, did a lot of work with Suffolk Wildlife Trust and Suffolk FWAG. So we've always been involved in the environment side of being linking it to farming. So yeah, it's pretty much a natural progression that we would sort of end up where we are today. Farming is the mindset we do at the moment.
Mm-hmm, okay. And returning to the family business, as we said, it was your grandfather who started the business and your father and uncle took over, and now you farm with your cousin. That could be seen as quite unusual in that you haven't fallen out, because that's quite unusual in farming family businesses. What's your secret?
I think we all have our own roles within the business.
Okay.
When my grandfather passed it on to my dad, Roy, and Dave and my uncle, they both had separate roles. So David was running the pig herd, doing all the crop marketing, mm-hmm. my dad doing the farm-to-farm sort of cultivations and running it from that side, and the accounts. And so they sort of had two very important roles,
yeah,
running from the side. They obviously locked heads, and like brothers do. So, but they sort of got through it because grandfather was in the middle, and grandfather was a very, very shrewd thinker, very good he had the foresight to put up massive sheds, which I now look at thinking, I'm glad he put a big shed up. One of the grain stores that we've got was the old cinema from the local Second World War base.
Oh, wow.
And so you could literally take an art tick up in it.
Cool.
And everyone always made to saying, well, why do you want to put such a big shed up? Because, well, tractors and trailers are only going to get bigger.
Yeah.
Sort of mindset my grandfather had. But then today, Patrick and I again have completely different roles. We have completely different mindset. We're obviously cousins, which means that we don't fall out mm-hmm. over the normal things that sort of get under your skin when you're a brother.
Yeah.
But I'm described as a farmer and conservationist, and Patrick's described as a conservationist and farmer. So we look at things completely different. My role is the farming side. Patrick then does the accounts, and then the other business enterprises that we're trying to look at, diversification, estate maintenance, and then our paths cross with conservation, which we're both very passionate about.
Yeah, okay. And another thing that could, I don't know if it's unusual, but your parents and your aunt and uncle are still partners, but they've left you and Patrick to get on with it. And the popular image in farming is of the sort of 70-year-old father still clinging onto the checkbook and the 45-year-old son still being seen as the lad. Do you think that's a big advantage for you that they've let you do that?
Yeah, but we haven't just acquired it. We've actually gone and asked our parents for it.
Mm-hmm.
So when Patrick was he went to university at Brunel and did sports science,
mm-hmm.
Worked for local football clubs and did sports coaching badges and things like that. But again, the opportunity came that we came back onto the family business at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And one weekend we went down the pub, had a few pints, started talking. Oh, this is quite a big opportunity. We could sort of forge our family business forward. And so we wrote down everything we didn't really like or thought we could improve on the bag packet after a few pints. And then we basically took it to our parents on a Friday afternoon and said, look, this is where we think that we can take our our family business with your blessing. And by the time that piece of paper had dropped on the desks, the trucks were outside running, and we would basically disappear for the whole weekend and let them just think about it. And then came back on the Monday and said, how did it go? We'll see what frosty reception we got in the morning. So we always have a nice early sit down and chat over what's going on. And they said, well, if this is what you think and you want to do it, then we're at the age where your grandfather passed the business onto us. So you've given us the perfect opportunity to do that, but then also allowed them to go and do other things. And so my father, the best bit of diversification any son can do was get your dad into local politics. he became district councillor for our local area. And this May, he'll be retiring after doing 16 years.
So
he went and did other things. He wanted to make his mark elsewhere.
Yeah.
He's done a brilliant job for the local government, Mid-Suffolk District Council. And then David's done other things with charitable work. He's now president of the local cricket club. But still, David is involved doing the marketing side with my help. And my dad sort of comes in, tells me how to do it, and disappears off. And but my dad has got so much knowledge. It's incredible what he remembers. And when you ask him where that water pipe was buried in 1973, he'll walk you to the spot and you'll find it.
Fantastic. So what were some of the initial things that you wanted to change? Where did you want to take the farm in those early days?
Well, the first thing that we looked at, we had the pigs, and for me, pigs was not what I wanted to do. I'm not a livestock person. And so that was the first big decision that we made, was to actually cease production of the full pig unit, all the way through fattening, all the way through to sale. So that was a big element. David had obviously brought it up. We were employing two pigmen. All our units were indoor. And it was 7 days' work for 4 days' pay. So it was an easy decision financially, which then meant that the biggest responsibility was the cropping side. And so we started looking at the efficiencies of the business. At the time, we had 8 or 9 little John Deere tractors, all with their little role, their niche. It wasn't efficient. So we started then looking at plans, looking at it. I've got two brilliant employees, Nick and John. John's been working for us for 40 odd years, and Nick's sort of similar age, been working for us for pretty much since I returned from Australia. And so with their help and their enthusiasm, because they're the ones who are on the seat learning all this new technology. And I take my hat off to John, because he's seen it all from when he started all the way through to now, with driving his big, the Fendt and all the GPS and everything. It's incredible what he's seen, but it's just, We've all looked at the efficiencies, and it was basically just making sure that our cost of production was as low as possible, making sure we weren't wasting time, making sure that everything was done on time, and getting the best out of it. And so we ran a very high input, high output system, which we did very successfully.
Okay. And when did you start looking at environmental schemes seriously for the farm?
Well, the farm, through my dad and uncle, weren't really in a scheme. There were schemes available, but David, with his background, didn't think it actually fit the actual schemes at the time, fit the farm. So we weren't in anything. So we had a blank canvas. And the high level stewardship was rolled out by Natural England. And Patrick and I, this literally coincided with sort of Pat and I had just got our feet under the table and sort of looking at it. And we basically went through and said, okay, we've got this opportunity to put our own stamp on the farm. David had planted lots of hedgerows in the 70s. My dad had drained the whole farm. They had their legacy. And so Pat and I looked at this as our legacy, that we could influence our local landscape and farming system. And so we wanted to do it our way. And so we started to learn everything that we needed to learn, what we had, where it was, what they needed, how we could get more of them. And basically built a whole system, a whole application around it. I did the whole application pack myself, so the full farm environmental plan, all the options, drew it up. Patrick then took on the responsibility of knowing and learning what was out there and what we needed to do it. So, and then we picked the easiest options that we felt could deliver the most, the quickest. And we put a very simple sort of idea of creating a farmland corridor of grassland through the middle of the farm, buffering the watercourses, using 43 kilometres of hedgerow and buffering them with margins to allow natural movement of wildlife, putting the wild seed mixes 500 metres apart, because we knew that a little yellowhammer in depths of winter will only fly 500 metres for a food source. Put wild seed mixes every 500 metres, try to keep a pollen nectar mix in between, and basically drew a plan up and implemented it over 10 years with Capital Works doing restoring old habitats that had basically got tired and forgotten about, used it as much as possible, and basically went through it. But the big thing for me was the identification of marginal land, land that didn't really produce the crops that I knew that we could do. So we then identified with yield mapping all the bits that over time hadn't really done very well. And so that was a very quick way of improving your average yield overnight, was get rid of all the worst bits.
Mm.
Basically put that back into environmental schemes, and majority of them still stay in environmental schemes today.
Okay, so what wildlife species do you have on the farm, and have you seen a drastic increase in numbers over the years?
Well, we've seen a lot. Patrick is more of the wildlife auditor than I am. I used to take pictures and then ask questions afterwards. But Patrick now has been gone into the bird ringing and IDs and all that sort of sound. So he's really up with it. But the big thing that Patrick's done is actually got involved with the local bird ringing group.
Mm-hmm.
He's a licensed ringer. And so over the last sort of 7 or 8 years, as he started to sort of build up his knowledge, I think on record on this farm, we've rung about 15,000 small birds on the farm.
Wow.
27% of those are all RSBB red list. We've got sort of the yellowhammers, the rebuntings, the tree sparrows. Patrick's now getting them in the hand, knowing how old they are, knowing if they're male or female, are they a breeding weight, are they not, why isn't that? We've got records going back all the way through to the start, because we were very wary that we're taking public money.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted, when that question in the Commons or politicians stood up and said, what's high level stewardship delivered for the taxpayer? We could then give them a categorical sort of list of a story of what we've done. And so, yeah, we've got restored pretty much 30 ponds for Great Crested Newts. Great Crested Newts have moved from sort of 3 ponds across to sort of 8 or 9 on one farm, and then we've actually got them over at Westhorpe on the main farm now, which is just by natural progression. There's just so much. We've got butterflies. I think off the top of my head, we've got 21 species of butterfly recorded. This year we added 2 new species of damselflies. So we've got scarce emerald damselfly and willow damselfly, after we employed a local retired agronomist, Hedley Wright, who has been doing wildlife auditing for us for a year and is very keen on his dragonflies, damselflies. So we've now stepped it up that we need to be really recording our impacts going forward. So yeah, we've got species lists for everything, and first sightings of the year, where we've seen it, how many. The bird ringing obviously helps. Grey partridge numbers have gone from sporadic 1 or 2 to this year we've counted pretty much 60 across the farm. So wow. Yeah, it's our farm is now buzzing, and yeah, we really enjoy it because everyone's benefiting from it, and we love to see everything going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've actually won several high profile awards for the work you've done, so that must make you realize that you're doing something right.
It's strange, because when we started out, we were just literally really rather raw, and we just did it how we thought it needed to be done, just by going back to the simple things of food webs and knowing what habitats they got. So we did it as the way we would have done by the book.
Mm-hmm.
Then we won the Suffolk Flag Conservation Award, back in 2008, and they said, look, you guys, you're nailing it. I think you should go for the national award. And we were like, well, we hadn't even heard about a national conservation.
Yeah.
And so we put our names in the hat, and we got a three-hour judging one afternoon in June, and then didn't hear anything, and then we were invited down to the House of the Commons. And, yeah, we were in the last three for the FWAG Silver Lapwing, which is their Farmland Conservation Award. And standing on the side of the Thames in the Houses of Commons for the first time ever, Jimmy Doherty was presenting the awards, and third, second came up. We went in it. I just turned to Patrick and said, oh, never mind. We won it. So we were completely shocked and sort of thrust us into the limelight, and they made quite a big effort to sort of to roll us out as the next generation of conservation-minded farmers. And that was sort of the start of the crest of the wave that we've sort of ridden for a little while. And then the next year we won the Farmers Weekly Countryside Farmer of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just one of those things. We sort of don't go out to sort of just get but it's really nice to be recognized, especially at national level,
of course,
because the doors have opened for us, because now people know who we are. We can phone up, ask people, say, this is what we've done. And yeah, it's amazing sort of what that idea of getting your name out there has done for a family business.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else you do is you work with the local community quite a lot. You provide access for walkers, you host visits for a wide range of groups and clubs. Why do you do this, and why do you think that's so important?
Well, at the end of the day, the education side of it, the tours, I think we're doing pretty much averaging 20 to 25 tours a year around the farm, and different tours, WIs, rotary clubs, lots of different sort of history groups for the history. So we meet and greet everyone on the farm and take them around for the farm for 2 hours, and basically try and spread the word and our knowledge and our enthusiasm, because at the end of the day, we wouldn't have been where we are and doing what we didn't if it wasn't for the money that's coming from the taxpayer, basically.
Uh-huh.
So we're trying to be advocates of a farming system that benefits not just the family business, but also the wider community. And so, yeah, we get involved with the Suffolk Show. I'm heavily involved with that. I'm on the education board for the School Farm Fair. I took on the chairmanship this year, which is another great event.
Uh-huh.
Just trying to sort of really open everyone's eyes to farming is open to everyone, and everyone should benefit from it, from having a healthy ecosystem. So
yeah, okay. So how did your involvement with the AHDB, the Agriculture and Horticultural Development Board, how did you get involved as a monitor farmer to begin with, and can you tell us what that involves?
It's quite a roundabout way I got there. I was quite critical of the HGCA, which was then back then, that they were taking my levy of wheat off every ton of wheat. And I was like, what am I getting back for it? Which I'm sure there's quite a few farmers out there who say the same thing.
Yes.
But being me, I wanted to know more. And I saw an advert for their Monitor Farm program, which was a brand new sort of program they're rolling out. And I sort of said, well, I've got nothing to lose. And so put my name in the hat, and I got an interview and had an interview with two board members of the AHDB, and basically told them that I didn't think that I was getting my value for money, and I wanted to make a difference. And I wanted farmers who thought they weren't getting their value for money to know that they could get their value for money. And this sort of made them sit up. And Tim Isaac, who was our area manager, who's now gone further up in AHDB, luckily saw the need for young and enthusiastic monitor farmers. And so he picked the first two phases, which obviously was Tom Bradshaw, Joe Franklin, Russ McKenzie were phase one. And then myself and, myself and Russ were second phase. I'm sure there was someone else in there. Yeah, that was it. So yeah, and so the young sort of whippersnappers of the East sort of took over. All three of them had Nuffield scholarships apart from myself. So I felt sort of already on the back foot. But then Tom had 100 odd people turn up to his first meeting, which was the first one for the Monitor Farm program in the East. And then everyone else followed on. We all had the same numbers. And then it became a bit of a competition to see who get the best average. Then sort of got to know everyone, got to know the real nitty gritty that the AHDB do behind the scenes, and basically sort of put 3 years work into the Montafarm program, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Started benchmarking, started to meet farmers in my area that I hadn't really met before. And basically they describe the whole Modern Farm program for the monitor farmers is you get told to undress your business in public and bare all. And that's what we basically did. So I showed everyone the worst bits and the good bits, and just did it in a very open and honest way, and made a lot of good friends out of it.
Okay, so we'll come back to to the strategic farm, which we are shortly. Yeah. But just before we get to that, I just want to ask you, in 2015, you changed your farming system to conservation agriculture. So you started direct drilling, strip drilling, cover crops, low input farming. What does conservation agriculture mean in practice to people who might not know?
Conservation agriculture is basically looking at the full farming system and all your impacts that you're having by the decisions you make. I worked out from the normal conventional system of a plow and sort of min-till system that I was moving about 7.5 million tons of soil a year just to put seed in the ground. Mm-hmm. And once you start learning about soil, doesn't want to be disturbed, the fungi, the bacteria, they all have their role. If you take a plow, a field, and you basically you're turning the whole of the ecosystem upside down, and you're saying basically get on with it to the soil biota, and it just shock it into a state of, oh my god, what's gone on? It's like if you turned your whole house upside down, could your family function? Probably not. So conservation agriculture is trying to be as sympathetic and working with nature as much as possible. So reduced pesticide, insecticides, pesticide reduction, looking at empowering the plant with micronutrition, biostimulants, so we're not so as nitrogen heavy. So my nitrogen usage has gone down, my pesticide usage has gone down. Introduced cover crops, doing a lot of work with the strategic farm about sort of nitrate leaching, and basically trying to get my soil and everything working in my favor instead of just bashing it about with a big lump of metal. Just trying to be as sympathetic as possible and aiming for a hybrid flexible system, so I can strip till, I can direct drill, I can still got the plow, I've still got the min till, I do what's appropriate to every single field. Do a lot of work in assessing the potential and then basically invest into that to keep my cost of production as low as possible. And so that's the sort of program that I'm running. And now we've opened the door to contracting work going forwards. We've obviously learned the skill of direct drilling and strip tilling. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be more push to that in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Was it quite a steep learning curve, or did it? was it? Because it's not easy to change an entire farming system, is it?
It was it's been a massive learning curve. Yeah. And I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And every day is a learning day is one of my mottos. We learn every single day what we did in the past. Record keeping has to be not just what you've done,
yeah,
but conditions, why it worked, what it didn't do, what you saw in that field. Was there a pan? Was there lots of earthworms? When was the last time it was in grass? We've got a 12-year rotation for cropping, so based around herbage grass seed for golf courses and football pitches. So I've got a long rotation, traditional grass lay in the middle of it. First wheat, we're blessed with producing good crops of cereals, and then using spring crops, spring linseed, spring beans, trying some canary seed this year, dropped oilseed rape, to basically...
That's a Freudian slip, oilseed risk.
Yeah, that's what I call it. It's one of those things that you just basically, there's so much involved that it's just, for me, so I've dropped it. Never looked back, and using cover crops to have green cover all the way through the year. Earthworm numbers, Jackie Strouse being out on the farm, seeing our earthworm numbers increase, where we've obviously sort of left them in state. And you see the they fall off a cliff when you put a plough or a combination unit or something into it. It is really scary, but that sort of detail, that attention to detail that I think all farmers need to sort of embrace going forward, because things are going to get tight with what's uncertain coming forward. But you need to understand the full system, because everything that sort of looking at with elms, with stewardship, you need to know your costs down to the nth degree. So the crop bench from the benchmarking program from AHDB, that's highlighted my cost of production. So previously, when I was moving nearly 7.5 million tons of soil, it was costing me, I think it was about £245 a hectare just to put seed in the ground. And then over my whole farm, over my whole cropping system. And then this last autumn, I think we averaged about £77 a hectare.
Jeez.
So, yeah, some huge savings. With that, I've got to be really aware that I know that in the very best years, I'll be producing the same level of output. I've still had crops do 11.5 plus tons. But I've got to be very aware that if something's not right, every time I move that soil, if I don't do it in the perfect conditions, then it's going to have a bigger effect. So basically taking the safety blanket of cultivations away. And that's been quite scary, that we're literally living and breathing and making every decision as to the highest detail that we possibly can.
Yeah. Okay. So that's going to segue nicely into hashtag soil my undies. how, what, and why is soil my undies?
Well, it all came about in my first year of Monitor Farm. We had done the first set of winter meetings, and there was really good response, and everyone, and they were sort of wary that during harvest the interest online on Twitter had sort of waned a bit, and they were a bit worried that numbers weren't going to be very good come the next set of winter meetings. And I was just perusing on YouTube, as you do, and Twitter, and saw a video on YouTube by Vince Blake, who's a Canadian soil scientist, and he had basically just dug up a pair of 100% cotton underpants, and I was like, what on earth is going on over the pond? And I hadn't heard anything about it, never seen it before, just looked into it, and he basically pulled this pair of Y-fronts out. And they were literally wearable. And he said, this is bad soil. This is, it's dead. There's nothing eating this 100% cotton underpants. And so, then he went over the road to a farm that's been in no-till for sort of 10 to 15 years. And all he pulled up was the elastic waistband and the polyester tag. And he said, this is what soil should be, full of microbes, full of fungi, full of earthworms. This is good. And it was just such a visual impact that two pairs of underpants, which have been buried for 8 weeks, could be completely different. And so I thought, well, why not try it in the UK? Spoke to the AHDB and said, look, this could either fall flat on its face or be a runner. And so I then buried the first set of cotton underpants in the UK by choice. There's probably been some buried which were and then I did a video, said, look, I'm going to try it, challenged all my other model farmers to do it. Russ McKenzie took me up, and so Russ and I had a pant off, and then we basically used social media and the hashtag saw my undies in the UK, because in America it saw my pants. So we saw my undies for the UK, and it absolutely took a storm and was a bit of a gimmick. But I ended up in the Sun, on the Telegraph, local paper, radio, and then recently it was featured on BBC TV on QI. So yes, I'm known as Soil Pants Brian in the Sun.
That might be the title of the show, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I guess it's just such an incredible visual, isn't it? I've looked at the pictures online. It gives such a dramatic visual representation of the experiment, doesn't it?
It's so cheap.
Yeah.
It's visual. Anyone can do it, from general public to gardeners to lawn owners. We're doing it now with the school children that come, showing them, giving them a pair of pants to go and go back and do it at school, put one under the hedge, put one in your allotment and see what happens. And yeah, it's amazing that they suddenly become aware that the stuff they're actually walking around and playing football on is actually a living sort of ecosystem in itself. And you think about a handful of soil, good healthy soil in your hand, that's got more microbes and more organisms in it than the humans on Earth. We really need to appreciate our soil more.
Definitely. Yeah, and are you encouraged that it is being talked about more, at least? I mean, certainly even the politicians are talking about the importance of soil now, aren't they?
Yeah, I think we've really lost connection with it. Like, going back to my grandfather, he had started off with horses. He then had the first 14 horsepower John Deere tractor in the area. He was literally a foot away from the soil, and when it got to a heavy clay bit, it would slow down, the engine would change. Now we're sitting in, 3 horsepower tractors, so much power that you can't even hear the engine change because they're all on tickover. And we're just obliterating, if it's in good condition or bad condition, we just carry on regardless, because we need to get over the ground quickly. So the appreciation of our soil is something that I'm glad that we're sort of harnessing. But that term soil health is so hard to determine what is a healthy soil. It's trying to get those indicators of what is a healthy soil. So you're looking at active carbon, you're looking at earthworm numbers, you're looking at the sort of carbon, you're looking at organic matter. There's lots of ways we can do it, but to actually pin a one thing to say your soil is healthy when they're so diverse and different, it's really, because basically around here, I learned this when I was at Lancaster, is that the last glaciation period was called the Ipswichian because it got as far as Ipswich, and basically I'm farming a whole load of glacial dump. So yeah, we've got clay, we've got glacial till, we've got old eskers, everything all underneath the surface. And yeah, we're just basically farming what was left by the last ice age.
Is that why you've got so many ponds on the farm?
Ponds basically come from the clay. Suffolk and Cheshire have the highest density.
Yes, that's right. Ponds,
Basically because of the clay. So that's just where the clay has been exposed, left, weathered. But then parts of my farm is like a bottomless sandpit. So they're like, how do you farm those two bits of the field? Looking at the technology, variable rate, soil EC scans, doing all this sort of stuff, layering up the information, and then farming every single bit to its potential is what we're trying to sort of advocate.
Okay. I'll just take you back to the AHDB. They mentioned a strategic farm before. You talked about that a lot during your talk at the Oxford Farming Conference in January, and we'll come on to that shortly. But how is it helping your farming business? I mean, you talked a lot about farmer-to-farmer learning previously. I mean, I guess that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I think the model that the AHDB are trying to sort of deliver is farmers like to talk to farmers. And to get into farmers' mindset, you need farmers to do it.
Yeah.
And so the Modern Farm program has been brilliant, and I would recommend every single farmer to get involved with their local Modern Farm. I go to the Modern Farm conference each year, and I'm amazed by the diversity of people attending the Modern Farms that they've got there who are prepared to open up and talk about their business. Your Modern Farm is the farm business level, and then they introduced the strategic farm, which I was the first strategic farm for cereals and oilseed in the UK, based in the east. And now there's Rob Fox in the west, Leamington. And we're basically being the host to bridging the gap between top research coming out of the sort of institutes and trying to deliver it on farm in demonstrations that farmers can then learn, see, and take away from our experiences that we're sort of promoting and showing. So it was a massive learning curve again, but getting farmers, agronomists on farm to talk about what we're aiming at, the idea of sort of the story that we're trying to create and tell farmers is about how we can lower inputs. What impact we have on the environment. So that's sort of what my sort of story is we're trying to tell with the AHDB. So we're looking at variety trials and I've got a variety trial with five different varieties, which all have the same yield on the RL. Mm-hmm. And I've got section of the field, which is going to be farmed with no inputs whatsoever from the sprayer. Then I've got how low can you go. Then I've got my farm standard, and then I've got the Rolls-Royce treatment, and they're all going to be done through the year, through this spring. And then we're going to overlay the last nitrogen top-up to farm into potential, which is another sort of buzzword which I use, and doing cost analysis on that. Then I've got nitrogen leaching. Nitrogen leaching for me, when sort of you look at it, it's costing the UK something 190-odd million to clear nitrate out. So most of it's coming from sort of farming in one way or another. Mm-hmm. Taking my field urine samples, which I call them. Luckily enough, working with Essex and Suffolk Water, I've been allowed to analyse my drain water from nine different fields. And the nitrate release on average from a overwinter plough, for instance, is 150 millilitres of nitrate, which is three times as much the EU water directive of 50 milligrams.
Yeah.
And that's just from leaving it over ploughed, so bare, letting the water run through it. Mm-hmm. So how can we improve that? So then we looked at the mintil where we just sort of stir the surface. Again, that was releasing 130 to 120, so not as bad, but still over the top. And then compared it against an overwinter cover crop, which is the direct comparison, the overwinter cover crop was releasing 5 milligrams.
Wow.
And it's mind-blowing that if you adopt more of this idea, and hopefully by showing and showing it, a farmer's learning and explaining it as a farmer wants to, that might sort of enlighten a few other people to go and try it, look at it. And so we've expanded the trial this year with the ADAS doing a full nitrate analysis on it. So there's some really interesting stuff that we're doing with them. I find that fascinating, the whole sort of idea of the nitrates. And then off the back of that, I saw the impact of really good biomass crops coming off last winter and the weaker ones. So then I was looking at a first wheat that was absorbing lots of nitrogen. When I put my first dollop of nitrogen on last after the beast from the east, I put the same amount on all my wheats, and we were late, so I thought, I'll just put 70 kilos of N on. And the ones behind the big biomass, the spike of the nitrates coming out of their drains was very little. Whereas behind the weaker second wheats with poor populations, with poor biomass, the spike was quite scary. And so that sort of idea of, can we manipulate early biomass to get bigger roots, absorb more nitrogen, be a bit more smarter with our first applications of nitrogen when the drains potentially still run? Can we just get a bit more clever? And so that's what we're looking at going forward. So, and then we've got other sort of trials and sort of experiments going on. Jackie Strau with her earthworms, visual soil assessments. There's loads of things. I think every single field on my farm has got a white cane somewhere in it.
That's really cool. So tell us about the other successful hashtag, not soil my undies, but #farmwildlife. Because you've been doing one tweet a day for a year about what you've done. You've had a huge, huge reaction, haven't you?
Yeah. I started it back in 26th of March, I think it was, from the top of my head. So we're just coming up to a year, and I thought, this is a challenge that I'm sure we can do. Found a good website scheduler. So I do sort of blocks of 10 tweets, and they get sent off. Did my research into when tweets were seen most. So 7:30 in the morning, when you all wake up and you get your phone, and the first tweet you should see is the one you remember. So most of mine go out at 7:30 on weekdays, 9:30 for a weekend. So that's what we aim to do. And we basically went through all the species that we had on the farm. I've taken loads of photos of species of birds and butterflies, and so we use them. Why should they be kept on a USB stick in my office when everyone should be seeing them? And basically then said how we got them, what we do, how we look after them, pond restoration, species-rich grassland, and how we've reintroduced that onto the farm, grey partridges, success stories, and the amount of interest that we've got. I think hopefully by – coming around to exactly a year, I think we're on track to be over 1 million views on that single hashtag.
That is incredible, isn't it? I mean, people dismiss social media as a bit of a nonsense, and it can be, but it can also be incredibly powerful, can't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, our most looked at tweet was Nick, who was combine driving our grass. We're using the Sherwin Reynolds stripper header on the grass, and he saw something moving around from the top of the grass, and so he pulled up thinking, oh, it might have been something sort of running around in it, and it turned out it was a whole brood of day-old grey partridge chicks.
Wow, okay.
And he was like, oh, crap, I don't want them to go through the combine. So he stopped, got out, emptied his lunchbox onto the seat, scooped up all the day-old chicks, took a photo of it. He could hear the mum and the dad calling, and so he walked them over to the grass margin, put them in the grass margin, and basically sent us a picture of the combine and said, this is what I've done. Do you want to put it on social media?
Yeah.
So, yeah, brilliant, yeah. And we had 75,000 hits in 48 hours.
Jesus. Wow.
And it's amazing what different things sort of go crazy. Yeah. Like pond restoration went absolutely mad. The it's a series of tweets that we did for the restoration of grassland with our seed relocation. That went absolutely crazy. Bird boxes, hedgerows, been really on Twitter a lot lately.
Mm.
Yes, it's amazing what really grabs the imagination and the emotion that other, not just farmers, but general public, who then learn because of what we're doing. And yeah, our followers have gone through the roof because of it, and they're general public, they're interested, they're school teachers, they're retired people, they're mums who've got children who are interested. It's the diversity, and we're sort of I just wanted to do it for a year. It's been quite hard work at times, trying to get information out. But we're on course to do one tweet a day for a year with hashtag farm wildlife. So, and then we'll keep using it, but not on a sort of intensive every day, but we'll try and do it as much as possible. But yeah, we're just really pleased that the reception's been great. And like last night, my phone was going absolutely mad with wild seed mix interest. So yeah, so it's trying to get the right subjects, really.
Absolutely, yeah, people listening, do make sure you have a look at the hashtag farm wildlife. And yes, and another hashtag, I've got to ask you about this, because you are doing another one at the moment, Local March, which is a really simple but very, very good idea. Tell us about that.
Well, it was obviously off the back of February. And there was nothing really for March, and I thought, well, why can't we sort of empower ourselves to change our habits to actually, because I get frustrated that, and I'm guilty as much, my wife and I would do one online shop a week. The delivery driver would turn up, would have a chat with them, and then our fridge would be full, regardless of where it's come from, because they will just pick what you said on your button on your computer has been picked.
Yeah.
And we've become disconnected from where our food comes from. And the personalities that know and love their food that they try and sell you. And so we've got a very good butcher who we're great friends with, Rolfs of Walsham, and Paul Hubbard there. Every time we go in there, he says, this is good. This cheese is coming. It's wonderful. Try it. I've got some really nice lamb in. I've got some beef in. What do you want? Do this, do that. Oh, I can wrap it up and I can marinate it. What do you like? Oh, your wife's a celiac. Oh, right. That's fine. I'll sort something else out. And so that communication and conversation while you're there, how's your wife and all this sort of stuff. That lost conversation, I think, really is an important part of local society. And so I just challenged everyone to basically not buy anything online for a month. Wrote a piece in the paper, did it on Twitter, haven't been as sort of sort of forthcoming with it, because I actually realized I was actually doing quite a lot anyway. It sort of changed a few people just to think about, actually, why go and buy something from a big online store when there's independent high street people out there who are really facing it quite hard at the moment with the uncertainty. Go and put some money in your local economy. Go onto your local high street. We used to do it before internet came along, we could write a list. It's not hard. Mm-hmm. Be there once a week, speak to people. You'll bump into someone. You'll then have a drink in a coffee house with them. You might have a pint on the way home from the pub. You then go to a local restaurant in that evening and you sort of spread that word. And especially with like Mother's Day coming up and things like that, it's a great opportunity to get out and help your local independent sort of high street stores. So that's what we're sort of trying to promote.
Well, it's, yeah, use them or lose them, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. So I mentioned the Oxford Farming Conference earlier. You spoke at the innovation session in January. Hugely prestigious thing, big honour. How was it? How did you find it?
Well, 10 years ago, I turned up as a wet behind the ear scholar, thinking, oh, this is all very high and mighty and yeah. Didn't know many. But then you sat down next to the sort of governor of the Agriculture Department of the USA, and you're like, crikey, this is quite interesting. I need to sort of pay attention, don't get too drunk.
Yeah.
And then 10 years on, I was then invited to talk about on-farm innovation. So mm-hmm. a decade has sort of gone from early day scholar at the Oxford Farming Conference to then speaking. And then I was like, oh, this is, I'm here on my own merit. I'm going to talk about a subject I know and I'm passionate about. And then you get up on stage and you just went, oh, there's a lot of people. Oh, there's minute batters. Oh, yeah. There's, oh, yeah, crikey. I need to sort of, where am I? My phone, I had my stopwatch on my phone because I only had 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I only had 10 minutes. And so I was like, oh, so I was on track. And my phone was going to sort of 5 minutes. And then the whole thing went to save your screensaver. And I couldn't get my time up. And then I was like, oh, well, I don't know how long I've got left. So it was a bit rushed at the end. But just the honor is yeah. something that I couldn't turn down. And just hopefully just trying to get sort of, it was basically talking about how to get more science onto farm, mm-hmm. more scientists involved. And I followed a great speaker, Christabel, and he just went out the gates like an absolute rocket.
Yes.
Spoke, and I was just like, how am I going to follow that? But yeah, again, it was a great honor. Really enjoyed it. The Oxford Farm Conference, if you haven't been, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah.
Just by the people that you get to rub shoulders with and talk about farming and politics and policy and everything else going forward.
Hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, and people listening, the talk is available online. If you search Oxford Farming Conference, Brian Barker, you will find it. Yeah, and I was in the crowd. I enjoyed it. You used a great quote, a farmer's eye is the best fertilizer, Pliny the Elder. I thought that was a really, really interesting quote to use.
Yeah, well, I do like a motto and a quote.
So. Yes, again, a tiny segue, because you do have a few mottos that you live by. Every day is a learning day. Enthusiasm brings luck, which I think that one really jumped out to me. Enthusiasm brings luck, I think.
That actually came from, I went on honeymoon with my beautiful wife to South Africa on safari. And Kaiser, our guide, was a really enthusiastic bloke. And we had one game drive that we didn't see very much. And he basically slowed down. He said, just enthusiasm, give me something to talk about. And so I had my long lens photo camera. I took a picture of a bird. And I said, Kaiser, what's this picture? And he goes, oh, brilliant. And he just suddenly erupted in this enthusiasm about this Carmi bee eater that was sitting on the fence, and he was just like, oh, this is such a wonderful bird, it nests here. And everyone on the game tray were like, well, this is really interesting. And then we saw another one in the tree, and he said, oh, this is a scaled leg vulture or something. And we were like, wow, this is, oh yeah. So, and that held us up on our normal trip round for about 10 minutes. And then we came around the corner and Kaiser's eyes nearly popped out on stalks, as did everyone else's, because this black rhino that there was only 13 in the whole of the reserve, was basically standing in the middle of the open. And if it was ever been on safari looking for black rhino, they normally see you and run.
Yeah.
Basically just stood there chewing grass.
Wow.
And I must have taken probably 1,000 pictures of it in the space of sort of 20 minutes because it didn't really have a care in the world. And he just turned to us and he goes, remember, enthusiasm brings luck, because if you didn't ask me the question,
yeah,
you weren't enthusiastic, we would never have seen this.
That's really cool. I really like that. Yeah, okay. So, and some of the other, think outside the box before you stay in it, and leave your farm once a day, leave your village once a week, leave your county once a month and leave your country every 6 months. I mean, that's a really good one.
Yeah, that's my grandfather said that. He was a great believer that you need to leave the bubble of farming.
Yeah.
Because you get so self-absorbed in it. And the thinking outside the box one is basically you just got to challenge your mindset.
Mm.
Don't get stuck in being in that box for too long.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, the hour's flown by, Brian, so I'm going to finish this with the traditional quick, hard-hitting questions, if you're ready.
Okay.
Okay, what's your all-time favourite song?
Nelly the Elephant by the Toy Dolls. I know the words and I know all the dance moves.
My five-year-old daughter's favourite song. She would heartily approve. You are very sporty. If you could be world-class standard at one single sport, what would you choose?
Looking at the England cricket team, I could probably do a better job in their own fashion at the moment.
Yeah.
To control a golf ball and play in the Ryder Cup would be pretty cool.
Yeah, right. I think that's probably the correct answer. If you could go out for a beer with anyone from history, who would you choose?
I would choose it's a bit of a trick, but I've probably got three people. Both my grandfathers, one I never met, who was the accountant at Carlisle Football Club when they went into administration. They saved them from going bankrupt.
Wow.
I never met him.
Wow.
So I'd love to have picked his brains.
Yeah.
Just said, hi, Granddad. Then my farming granddad, because he died in 97, so I never got really to ask him about what he thought of today's farming and the technology that we're doing with today compared to what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And then David Attenborough is someone I always sort of think has just got so much knowledge, and he's seen a lot of things in his life, and it'd be good to have a dinner party with them three.
Absolutely. Good answer. Okay. You've achieved a hell of a lot in your career to date, but what are you most proud of?
The awards, I don't really, not interested.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than my general approach that I've been brave enough to challenge my mindset, I'd say.
Yeah.
Don't just get suckered and sucked along in the same way. That's the way we've always done it.
Mm-hmm.
Really challenge yourself, because you're going to be challenged in the future. And if you challenge yourself every single day and learn every day, then that's what I say. Just keep challenging yourself.
Brilliant answer. Okay. And lastly, then, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
Dodging the sort of real point of the question for the agricultural side, but two people that I think are very good at communicating conservation to everyone, not just sort of conservation people, but farmers.
Mm-hmm.
There's Richard Negus, who is at Trooper Snooks, and he does a great video, live from the hedgerow, and he's sort of a Suffolk hedge layer, and he's really good at sort of communicating conservation and the role it plays in the bigger thing. He writes for the Shooting Times.
Yeah.
And then I met Rob York at the Oxford Farming Conference when I was a scholar 10 years ago, and at Black Gull, and he's very good at communicating the balance between conservation and farming. So for me, those two guys need a shout out because they're doing great jobs and keep up the good work.
Yeah, great answers. Right, Brian, it's been fantastic to speak to you. Like I said, I really, really enjoyed your talk at Oxford. So I decided then and there when I was in the audience that I wanted to get you on the podcast, and really glad I did. Really enjoyed speaking to you.
Well, it's been great catching up, and thank you very much for inviting me to be on this great podcast, and keep up the good work.
Cheers, Brian. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.